It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the cinemas and on DVD. Get ready for...
Wait for it!
Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's find out how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Hello, film lovers, and welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. The show is also available as a podcast. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, and this week it's just you and me. I'm hosting and producing, so it's all right, intimate. Our Film Sociology. Do want to give a big shout out to the cast and crew of The Three Musketeers, their final two performances Friday and Saturday night, tonight and tomorrow night at Mud Creek Players. Directed by yours truly, self-indulgent director's cameo, as well as not self-indulgent, not nepotism, but a wonderful cameo, three roles by Film Sociology kids film correspondent Emma Sosi. We get a chance to go see The Three Musketeers. And while you're at it, Around the World in 80 Days at IRT. Another wonderful, famous story put to the stage with multi-character actors and a very simple set. Well, ladies and gentlemen, depending on what age you are, summer has officially begun, if you're of college age or college faculty. And we know that summer's officially begun, sort of, at the movies. Not because of the release of Babies, which also opened nationwide. I've already been informed by a kids' film correspondent that a Babies and Oceans double feature might be in the works at the Sosi House. If Oceans is still in theaters, it didn't open all that strong and it's starting to slowly die out. However, opening in theaters this weekend, and there was a bunch of people at the midnight screening last night, apparently made $7.5 million nationwide at the midnight screening, bully for them. But yes, Iron Man 2. Robert Downey Jr. is back as Tony Stark in Iron Man. Gwyneth Paltrow is back. Not as a blonde, again. Jon Favreau is back as the Man Friday, I guess, for Tony Stark, as well as the director. New faces, Mickey Rourke, Sam Rockwell, and more of a one-eyed presence of Samuel L. Jackson. So, ladies and gentlemen, where's the trailer? Just a reminder, you have a question or a comment, and you ask, why am I producing? You can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org, also on Facebook. But, yes, the first big summer blockbuster in May. It was bound to happen, I suppose. It's quite all right. Let's try this. There it is. Oh, my goodness. So, had a screening of it Tuesday evening, and just a report, only one person, one man, showed up with the Iron Man helmet and his mother. Too old for both. Give a listen.
Can we pick up now where we left off? Mr. Stark, please.
Yes, dear.
Can I have your attention?
Absolutely.
Our priority here is to have you turn over the Iron Man weapon to the American people.
Well, you can forget it. We're safe. America is secure. You want my property? You can't have it. But I did you a big favor. I have successfully privatized world peace.
We're adjourned for the day. You've been a delight.
Okay, give me a smooch for good luck. I might not make it back.
Go get him, boss.
You complete me.
Guilty man, you try to rewrite your own history. And you forget all the lives the Stark family has destroyed. There will be blood in the water, and the sharks will come.
If I believed in the concept of man cards, I'd have to turn mine in, because Scarlett Johansson is also in the film. Don Cheadle takes over for Terrence Howard. You heard Gary Shandling at the beginning. Nice to see Gary in a big film. He's got a couple of roles. And loads of music by AC/DC, even though it's still a Black Sabbath song that's connecting the title. Anyway, we move on. Well, folks, this is what I would call, in the blockbuster sequel world, this is a stepping stone film. This time around, of course, Tony Stark has Whiplash, played by Mickey Rourke, and a rival billionaire, played by Sam Rockwell, as his two arch-nemesis. And what I mean by stepping stone film is that it's setting us up for what will hopefully be a bigger and better third film. That's not a slight for the most part on Iron Man 2. It just kind of happens. If you really think about it, the ending of Dark Knight, you could consider a stepping stone film, even though The Dark Knight, I think, is an excellent film nonetheless. But this film follows the summer blockbuster rules, for the most part, to the letter. Return as many characters as possible, which, for the most part, they have. I mean, they have to replace Howard with Cheadle, and that's a whole other story. Hopefully they just won't shove another black actor in. Third one, Cheadle will stick around. And add new characters. So we have Scarlett and Sam and Mickey. Yeah, because the first name basis, because I know them. And more explosions and more fights, which there are. One aspect of the script that I'm not thrilled with and is a hindrance is the Tony Stark / Iron Man dealing with celebrity. As we all know, at the end of the first Iron Man, he said the famous line, which, you know, caused the song by Black Sabbath to play again. And so the fact that he's out in the open, and I know comic book nerds will, I'm sorry, graphic novel, no, comic book enthusiast, I know I've had a little bit of issue with that. I talked to a few of them, including my buddy JC. And I don't need to deal with, I don't need my superheroes dealing with being a celebrity. That's just me. There's a scene at a party where Tony Stark's character is wearing the outfit and just had a little too much to drink. And for me, that ranks right up there with Saturday Night Fever Peter Parker in Spider-Man 3. A little embarrassing. A little embarrassing on that. Downey is solid, But there's not a big shock as to how good he is in this film compared to the first film. It was nice to see Downey return to form in the first Iron Man film. We hadn't seen him like this in a while. And we knew he was going to be his usual charming rogue self in this one. So that's not a surprise. Very similar parallel to Johnny Depp in the first Pirates of the Caribbean to the last two, and apparently a third. So we'll see what that has to do. But that surprise element is gone. Another disappointing factor is Mickey Rourke is woefully underused in this, but at the same time, he's finally getting his paycheck for The Wrestler. You know, he got the nomination for that, for a little independent film for almost no money, and then he cashed in with a big blockbuster film like this, and Stallone's film coming out in August, The Expendables. This is very similar for me to Thomas Hayden Church, who did Spider-Man 3 to get the paycheck finally for his work in Sideways. So not really used. I mean, and I like everybody in it. Sam Rockwell does a good job as the rival rich guy who wants to create his own Iron Man characters, or I should say his own Iron Man war machines. Cheadle's fine. Paltrow and Johansson, yeah, Scarlett Johansson in tight clothes, whooping tail. That's always a fun thing. My wife and daughter aren't here to make faces at me, so it's really okay. Those two issues aside, I still enjoyed it. I still liked it. Good action, good popcorn film, which is what we need nowadays, apparently, because school's almost out. So, yeah. Just hopefully, and yes, stay for the closing credits. You want to see the little bit, and the screening I went to downtown on Tuesday, I'd say maybe a third of the audience stuck around for the little cookie after the closing credits, and yes, there were cheers and applause, and sure, why not? Don't forget, that film, directed by Kenneth Branagh, that'll be interesting to see. So hopefully we will have a better third film, a good, not a great, Iron Man 2.
Now that was a good movie.
It was. It was. So, just a reminder, later on in the show, I'll have a chat with writer Neil Gaiman. Emma will also ask a question. Of course, this is the man who created Coraline and Stardust, among others. And he was in town a few weeks back and had film sociology. No fooling. Film sociology had the exclusive, Indianapolis exclusive interview with Neil Gaiman. So we'll play that in a little bit. But first, we're going to take a short break, and we're going to talk about what is new on DVD. M. Socey, if you have a question or a comment, MSOCEY at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the point, WFYI.org.
We'll be right back. Are either one of these any good?
I don't watch movies.
Well, have you heard anything about either one of them?
I find it's best to stay out of other people's affairs.
You know who I can do without? I can do without the people in the video store.
Which ones?
All of them.
What would you get for a 6-year-old boy who chronically wets his bed?
So do you have any new movies in?
Do you have that one with that guy who was in that movie that was out last year?
They never rent quality flicks. They always pick the most intellectually devoid movie on the racks.
Ooh, Navy SEALs!
It's like in order to join, they have to have an IQ less than their shoe size.
Just go open the video store.
Yeah, open the video store.
And the video store is open. Welcome back to Film Sociology, Film Talk Show, here on WFYI HD2 The Point, and WFYI.org. Also available as a podcast on Mondays. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook. And a big shout-out to the cast and crew of Mud Creek Players' production of The Three Musketeers. Final two performances, Friday and Saturday night. Thank you very much for all of your hard work. Got three titles on DVD, new titles, and then a couple of old titles on Blu-ray, which we'll get to in a little bit. But, yes, I'm starting the show, the DVD segment, off with a little segment I like to ask.
Where were you? Where the fuck were you? Where were you? Where the hell were you?
And this week's Where Were You question goes to the big budgeted musical Nine, directed by Rob Marshall. Thing only made, I think, $18 million. Yeah, big, big disappointment at the box office, and a film that made my top five. So I ask again.
Where were you?
Okay, that's... Sorry.
Where were you?
Well, and that's a shame. Of course, the musical, movie musical, based on the Broadway production, the Broadway version, the musical version of Fellini's Eight and a Half. Daniel Day-Lewis, yes, Daniel Day-Lewis, not Javier Bardem, not Antonio Banderas, and sadly, not Raul Julia. But Daniel Day-Lewis plays Guido, the film director, who's working on his next project. He's stuck. He is stuck. However, he does have in his life and in his imagination all of the women in his life. And what a gaggle of ladies. Penelope Cruz as his mistress. Marianne Cotillard as his wife. I should have done that in reverse order. That's okay. Judi Dench as his costume designer. Nicole Kidman as his muse. Sophia Loren as his mother. And Kate Hudson as the reporter. Oh, and Fergie as the whore who lives near the beach. Take a listen.
Directing a movie is a very overrated job. We all know it. You just have to say yes and no. What else do you do?
Nothing.
Maestro, should this be red? Yes. Green? No. More extras? Yes. More lipstick? No. Yes, no. Yes, no. It's directing.
Be Italian. Be Italian. Take a chance and try to steal a fiery kiss.
Don't just hold me, but hold this.
false liar, darling. Go out there and lie richly. Lie for Italia.
I'm stunned that not as many people enjoyed this film as much as I had. I know I got incredible grief from my Indiana Film Journalists Association cohorts that I liked it so much and even put it in my top five. I had a lot of fun watching this. And not just because I'm a Fellini fan and I love 8 1/2. And no, I've never seen the musical on stage. It's okay. You don't have to. But love the energy. Love the sexiness. I mean, Penelope Cruz got an Academy Award nomination. I think she did for her song. Drove me crazy. In a good way. But no, really enjoyed the storyline. I know a couple things I heard from IFJA cohorts. Somebody who's not thrilled about the tortured writer, the tortured artist story. I don't mind that. If there's a tortured ditch digger and they can make a musical out of that, I'd give it a shot. And somebody, it was Ed Johnsonat, who said, because he said it here on the show, that he's not crazy about a musical about writer's block. And then, of course, I brought up Barton Fink, and Joe Shearer later said on Facebook, adaptation, and we were told to be quiet. Enjoyed everybody singing in it. It's not celebrity okay. Even Kate Hudson. Kate Hudson put in a good number. And Kate Hudson's in a film that did not irritate me. That is said to be something. But I think everybody did a really good job. Enjoyed the singing, enjoyed the dancing, enjoyed the look. Just a fantastic look of Italy in the 60s. And I just had a lot of fun, and it moved me. Maybe it was my inner artist, but I really, really enjoyed myself. And unlike the Pulitzer Prize winner up in Chicago, I do remember some of the songs from this musical. So there. So hopefully this is a film that will get more of an opportunity on DVD and Blu-ray. Some of the items on Blu-ray, of course, commentary by Rob Marshall, and some Blu-ray exclusives, if I remember correctly, basically a gushing over how great Daniel Day-Lewis is, and a chat with Sophia Loren about working in the famous Rome studio, film studio. So hopefully you will go check this out. Okay, also on DVD and Blu-ray this week is the latest film from Francis Ford Coppola. Yes, Tetro, which stars Vincent Gallo in the title role, Aldrin Ehrenreich, hope I'm saying that right, and Klaus Maria Brandauer. Good to see him again. And this is a story of a young man out of the Navy going to Buenos Aires to find his brother, Tetro, played by Gallo. And he finds his brother's script, a script about their famous music composer, father, played by Brandauer. Maribel Verdú is in this as well, if you remember her from Pan's Labyrinth. She plays Tetro's better-looking half. And this is a return to a film, a small film, written and directed by Francis Coppola. If you saw Youth Without Youth, which visually looked good, story-wise a little dull, but I understand maybe he had to make that film in order to make this film. It's Tetro's very operatic, probably Coppola's most operatic story, except for maybe The Godfathers. But good banter between the two brothers. And anytime I can find Vincent Gallo not irritating, that's a good thing. So a few people saw it in theaters. Hopefully more will check it out on DVD.
Now that was a good movie.
And I can't believe I'm responding to this as well, but also on DVD this week and Blu-ray, the first film that opened the first week of January 2010, the romantic comedy Leap Year with Amy Adams, there's a plus, along with Matthew Good, remember him from Watchmen and Matchpoint, and Adam Scott, who plays Amy Adams' boyfriend, who will not commit, and apparently there's the Irish folklore tradition of the woman being able to propose to the man on February 29th, and of course she flies out to Ireland to find her business boyfriend, and winds up traveling with Matthew Good, and of course they don't like each other. This is a romantic comedy that is very predictable, looks gorgeous thanks to director Anna Tucker, who gave a Shop Girl and Hillary and Jackie, but it's not psychotic. They're not backstabbing each other. It's not a Kate Hudson, Matthew McConaughey type of thing. So between that and the maybe I was giving more credit for what it is not than what it is, But I actually enjoyed myself, and it looked good. And Amy Adams is somebody I enjoy watching. Yeah, I even enjoyed her and Julia. Get over it. So this could be the date movie. Not Date Night. That's a whole other film. But give this one a look.
Now that was a good movie.
Okay, we are going to move on. A couple weeks ago, I had a chat with author, writer, screenwriter, and overall really cool guy, Neil Gaiman, who is in town. Spoke at our libraries, talked about how we shouldn't close all the libraries. But Neil Gaiman, of course, best known for Coraline and Stardust, among others. But he took some time out to talk with me and Emma to talk about his work and the rumors on the internet. Here's my chat with Neil Gaiman. Well, Neil, I didn't realize I had royalty in my studio, because I know you have an official title, so I need to kiss your ring or your scepter or what, your crown.
I have an official title, but only for a week.
Really?
Yeah.
You got to renew that.
No, I've inherited my title from, I think, Julie Andrews, and I do not know who I will be handing it on to next year. But I am the honorary chairman of National Library Week. I get to be a spokesperson for all of the libraries in America, and I get to tell people not to close them and to go and use them and to cherish them.
Ah, so you came to Indianapolis at the right time.
I did.
Are we chaining ourselves any libraries in the next couple of days?
Well, I'm actually going to be giving a big talk tonight that is absolutely sponsored by your local library world, which is rather wonderful. But no, I won't be chaining myself to any railings or throwing myself under horses. I'm just going to be urging people to use their libraries and to know what they've got. You know, we're in this world now where I keep hearing people telling me that libraries are so incredibly 20th century, as if Google replaced the library somehow, and trying to explain to them that the nature of information retrieval has simply changed.
I think with libraries, and for lack of a better comparison, video stores. I know, yes, you can get anything on the web and get it mailed to your home, and you don't have to see human beings. But I still think, especially a library, is a great example of the search. The search, the hunt, and whether you get what you're looking for or you find something else that comes along your path. I think that's a thrill that needs to remain.
I look back at the years I spent as a schoolboy, hanging around school libraries, discovering books that I did not know that I wanted. They weren't things that I was looking for. In many cases, they looked extremely unprepossessing. I remember some very, very old, battered-looking red hardbacks. One was called The Fellowship of the Ring, which seemed an incredibly unlikely sort of title. And then they had one called The Two Towers, and there were just two out of these apparently three books. And reading them and then getting to the end of The Two Towers and going, it can't end there. And so going back to the beginning and just reading those first two books of Lord of the Rings over and over again. And I don't know that I would ever have picked them up. But they were in the school library, and I was reading my way through it. So I read them.
And now they're on Blu-ray. And you can't read Blu-ray, really.
You can't. Incredibly sensitive fingers, possibly, to run around the disc.
That is true. That's true. Braille. What are you currently working on? I mean, whatever medium. It's literature, comic, film. What's in your office?
Right now, it's a bit of a gallimaufry. I've got, what am I working on? I'm doing a rewrite of an episode of Doctor Who that I wrote.
Oh.
I wrote an episode for the current season that was meant to be episode 11, but we ran out of budget. So my episode got bounced to early in season 6. So I'm doing a rewrite to take care of continuity issues and things from where it was to where it will be. I'm writing a film script for Anansi Boys, my novel.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on a non-fiction book about China and myth and history, which I'm starting to get into and starting to enjoy. And writing a little children's book in down moments right now.
How do you select down moments? Or, I mean, as far as juggling and writing, I mean, is it based on what creativity comes from this project or deadlines? Or, I mean,
well, there's definitely a level on which who is shouting loudest for something and when it was really due by and when it is due by and whether or not their lawyers have started sending letters saying, please note the date of the actual contractual delivery has now passed by several years and we will ask for our money back. These are all important things in what you work on. And then there's other things like what you feel like working on that day. And I always like to have something on the go in little notebooks just to hand, because you never know when you're going to wind up stuck on a plane or a hotel or an airport lobby or somewhere. And it's really nice to just sort of go visit somewhere fictional.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about, I love the idea of the credit writer / producer. You know, many people say, like, when they argue about the Academy Awards, that really producer and director, best film, best picture and best director should be the same. And some of us say that best writer and best picture should be the same. So I'm wondering, I know you were executive producer on Beowulf and producer on Stardust. How much were you able, and I don't mean this way this sort of sounds, but I mean, how much creative control did you have in collaborating with both directors of those films?
I think the truth is that film will always be subject to budget limitations, a director's medium. I've now directed a couple of films, not very long ones. I did a half-hour film a few years ago, and last summer I had enormous fun directing an 8.5-minute silent movie called Statuesque, which got starring Bill Nye. And in each case, what I liked best was I had the same power that I have as a writer in writing prose, which is the power of because I say so. Why is it like this? Because I say so. It's going to be like this. And that's something that you could have every producerial description in the book applied to you, whether it's executive producer, or you can be the boss of a studio. And the truth is, a director is going to make the film the director wants to make. And the director is the only person in a film, really, who has because I say so power.
How have you liked the film versions of your work so far?
I've really enjoyed them. I think I'm tremendously lucky.
You have no visible scars, so it seems like it's...
No, well. I really don't. And I'm fascinated by them. I think people think I'm a bit odd because I tend to take an incredibly long-term view anyway. And I think of film adaptations of my stuff as being kind of like theatrical adaptations, which is they come, they go, they're really interesting, but the book is still the thing. I love Stardust, the movie that Matthew Vaughn made. I was a producer on it. I really, really enjoyed it. I can also absolutely imagine a world in which 15 years from now, 20 years from now, somebody picks up the book, reads it, goes, I love this book. Then they look at the film that Matthew made and they go, you know, I want to do a different one. Mm-hmm. I'm reading this book, I'd love to make a movie of this, but it would be a completely different movie. It wouldn't be a sort of rollicking, comedic...
De Niro and drag. The most beautiful witch in cinema history.
Absolutely. you know, it wouldn't be that thing. It would be something else. Coraline, I think, was slightly different in that for Coraline, when I finished the book, this is when I finished writing the book, 10 years ago, I looked at what I'd written and I thought, I would love this filmed. And then I thought, but if you filmed it live action, you're going to get something that no adult would be able to watch without being too creeped out, and I'm not even sure that kids would enjoy it. And I thought, but I love Henry Selick's work. I'd loved Henry most famously directed a film, or before Coraline most famously directed a film called Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas, which a lot of people, because of the title, think was directed by Tim Burton.
Right.
But it wasn't. It was by Henry. And I had seen the credits on that, and I had registered who directed it and who made that film. And likewise, James and the Giant Peach. So for me, there was only one person I wanted to do Coraline, and only one person I was going to send the book to when it was finished, which was Henry. And fortunately for both of us, he read it, he loved it, and then it took us about 5 or 6 years to get it set up. And then, because it was stop motion, which is the most labor-intensive form of filmmaking on the planet, it took, you know, a year of pre-production set building and model building, and then 2 years of shooting. And on a really, really good day, they might get 11 seconds in the can.
And he has, of all the animators out there, I think his look is the most visible. You may not know him by name, but you know that look with the three films that you mentioned. And also, I think last year is going to go down as one of the best, if not arguably the best, year for film animation between all of the stuff that was nominated. And congrats on the nomination.
It was so strange being in that year. And that we got an Oscar nomination in what may have been the best year for animation ever was an honor in itself.
And that could have been a category with 10.
Oh, it could easily have been a category with 10. And also, there was a level on which, and I say this in the best possible way, Up was nominated for Best Picture.
Mm-hmm.
Which meant, and you sort of look at that and you go, well, it won't get Best Picture, but it has to get Best Animated Picture because it's been nominated for Best Picture. So it was the most stress-free Academy Awards possible. We knew that Up would win. Everybody involved knew that Up would win. And
you got your swag bag and went out drinking afterwards.
And we had a wonderful time. Exactly. So from that perspective, it was great. I got to write the thing that I wrote that I think has had the most number of people ever seeing it, which is 15 seconds of Coraline dialogue in the Academy Awards. I wrote that for them, that little scene, and I'm going, I think that there's something ridiculous, like 250 million people watching this right mm-hmm. now.
It's fabulous. When it comes to adapting your work, first off, do you have it strictly that, you know, you get to adapt your own work and nobody else, or is it, I mean...
Truthfully, I prefer it when other people adapt my work.
Okay.
And I'm currently battling my way through an Anansi Boys adaptation that reminds me. The only reason I said yes to it was the BBC World Service had just done a radio adaptation of Anansi Boys that I had not liked and really hadn't liked, which meant that about a week after, I got a call from Warner Brothers saying they would like to buy the rights to Anansi Boys. Would I like to adapt it? And I was like, yes, I really do. Because I want to do this properly. Now that I'm doing it, I'm remembering why I normally say no to adapting other people's stuff, which is simply, in order to build the thing in the first place, your mind goes down certain paths. When you're transferring something into a film, you either want to do exactly the same thing that you did before, which is a bit dull if you're a writer,
mm-hmm.
or you want to do something completely different just because it's fun and you haven't written it. And neither of these is I think, terribly healthy for a writer. It's much more fun for me adapting something by somebody else because then I can go with a completely clean conscience. I can look at it and go, well, you know, we can lose that character. I can't do that with my stuff. If I go, well, we can lose that character, in the back of my head, that character is going, no, why me? I was a good character. I was obedient. You can't lose me.
Well, I was curious also about your adaptation of Beowulf, because it seemed more, especially after a certain animated action film had come out, but it seemed more like a Shakespearean tragedy than, say, beefy guys screaming and hacking at one another.
It's a very odd film, Beowulf, isn't it? I mean, I think part of the fun of that, and which is one of the things that some people like and some people don't, and different people react in different ways, is what Roger Avery and I wrote a script for in our heads was for a $15, $20 million low budget, lots of mud and dirt Beowulf that would have been kind of like Terry Gilliam's Jabberwocky.
I was saying, my first thought was Excalibur.
I think in our heads we had a weird mixture of Excalibur, Jabberwocky, and maybe Monty Python and the Holy Grail in terms of that kind of what we were trying to do. Bob Zemeckis fell in love with the script, and then, which suddenly meant that it was a thing starring Anthony Hopkins and Angelina Jolie and people, and Bob is also fascinated right now by motion capture and by performance capture and by ways of trying to do the thing where you get to mix live action performances with an animated thing that you're seeing on the screen. So it became this kind of thing that looks like a video game, but doesn't necessarily deliver. I think for a lot of people, it looked too much like a video game for the people who actually really would have loved the Shakespearean oddness. And it was too little like a video game for the people who would have really liked a video game movie. And the people who, for whom it would have been very funny and very weird if we'd actually done it as a Jabberwocky thing, they never really got to see that. I think Roger Ebert was about the only film critic I saw who basically said, I think I'm the only film critic who has noticed this is funny. And it is funny. And it's funny. People, it's funny, which I loved.
Now, I went online, because that's where I get all my research, and I saw that there's five titles in your IMDb page under In Development. So, may I throw titles at you and you can comment?
Throw titles at I have to say that as far as I can tell, IMDb has the same kind of reliability as Wikipedia, which is anybody can go on and add anything they like.
Well, we're gonna straighten this out.
So go for it.
Here we go.
It.
All right. Graveyard Book.
Definitely in development. Neil Jordan is writing the script currently and is meant to be directing it.
Okay.
There's serious hope that we could be shooting by the end of the year.
Death, High Cost of Living.
Don't know. It's Death, the High Cost of Living is kind of like traffic lights. You know, I always thought when I was a young person entering the world of Hollywood nervously that the expression a green light meant that you actually had a proper green light for your film and you would go. And I didn't realize that it was kind of like traffic lights, because green lights for death go on, and then they go yellow, and then they go red, and then they go...
I was thinking the Monty Python song, but yeah, that's one of those.
So it's very, very strange. Had you asked me that 4 days ago, I would have told you that we were closer than ever before to things happening. I'd just been contacted, and the deal had just been done for me to go in and do a rewrite of my original script, and everything was grand. As of 2 days ago, Warner's apparently suddenly have had a unified field theory for the entirety of Sandman and everything I created, which no longer involves, for which death is now on hold. So, I don't know. We'll find out.
We'll call you next week.
Exactly.
Road to Endor.
Road to Endor is wandering along. And it's kind of fun. It's a script that I've written with Penn Jillette of Penn and Teller.
Yes.
A true story about some two guys in 1917 who escaped from a Turkish prisoner of war camp by pretending to have psychic powers and doing stage magic. And it's a completely true story about these wonderful people and the producer. There's a producer named Hilary Bevan-Jones who I've worked with in London, who actually produced Pirate Radio. She produced The Girl in the Cafe. And it actually happened to her grandfather. Her grandfather was one of these two people.
Oh, wow.
So she's working with us on it. And we're just waiting for... There is a director that we want. he wants to do it. He's been tied up on a franchise of films that has occupied him for several years now. I believe he's shooting the last of them currently, and then we'll see if he's available.
Okay. Interworld.
That looks like it's happening, but as a TV series, not as an animated TV series, not as a movie.
Okay. And finally, Black Hole.
Black Hole, Roger Avery, who I did Beowulf with, who did Killing Zoe and Pulp Fiction,
yes,
co-writer of Pulp Fiction, and I wrote a script for Black Hole.
I guess I'm,
as far as I know, it's in a black hole right now.
I was saying, is this a remake of the Disney film of the same
thing? No. This is Charles Burns' wonderful graphic novel about
a
sexually transmitted disease that turns kids into teenagers into monsters.
Completely.
And forces them to go and live in the woods.
On a double bill with the Disney film.
And
that black hole was blue, by the way. From 1980.
So no, all of the, actually that's not bad. All of those films are actually real things.
So okay.
Normally when people say, oh, I've seen this on IMDb, they come up and say, so are you really doing Doctor Strange with Guillermo del Toro? And I say, no, I'm not. I really am not.
Well, after a while, it just seems like, you know, for me, it's like, I don't believe it until I see a poster and a trailer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when actually things have happened. I had two friends, well, basement-dwelling friends, who were going to come to fisticuffs over Ken Branagh playing young Obi-Wan in the first three Star Wars. And I thought, really, you guys are going to fight over that? So that's why we check in.
I love, I really do love the way that people seem to think that films are inevitable, that writers have supreme control, and that you can actually tell them what's going to happen with a film. The only thing that I know, having done all sorts of films and having knocked around in Hollywood now for 20 years every now and again, is nobody knows anything. And what will happen, and if you'd asked me in 1997 what film of mine was most likely to happen, I would have told you Beowulf, because Roger, we've just been given the green light, and Roger was about to fly around Canada, Newfoundland, Greenland, looking for locations.
Places with mud.
Absolutely. And then if you'd asked me in 2004 if any of the film scripts I'd written would never get made, I would have said, well, definitely Beowulf. That one will never happen. That's sitting there. It's this complicated chain of ownership. Who's going to make that thing? And so I was wrong both times. These days, all I know is that they will happen when they happen.
And you love libraries.
And I do love libraries. you have a daughter.
I do. This is our film sociology kids film correspondent, Emma Sosi, and I know she's been chomping at the bit. You have questions and or comments for Neil?
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, how long did it take you to write the book?
Of Coraline?
Yeah.
You know, that shouldn't be a really hard question to ask somebody. You say, how long did it take you? And they tell you. The problem with Coraline, though, is I'm not really sure. I started writing Coraline in about 1990, maybe early 91. I showed it to an editor who read the first three chapters and said, Neil, which is what I'd written. And he said, it's really good, but obviously we can't publish it, because it's horror for children, and that's too weird. And then I moved to America. So for a period of about 6 years, I would write about 2 pages a year on Coraline. I'd just go and write a little bit. By about 1998, I noticed, and I moved out here in 92, I noticed that the daughter I'd started writing it for, Holly, was now probably getting to be too old for it, and that I had a young daughter who was now 4, and if I didn't get a move on, she would be too old for it by the time I finished it. So I sent what I'd written of Coraline up to that point to my editor, a lady named Jennifer Hershey, and she phoned me up and she said, it's really good, what happens next? And I said, if you send me a contract, we'll both find out. So she sent me a contract, but I didn't have any more time. So instead of reading before bed, which is what I'd always done up until that point all my life, I started writing before bed, and I had a notebook by the side of my bed, and I would write 50, 60, 70 words of Coraline, and then I'd go to sleep. And then finally, in about 2000, I went on a cruise for the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, which is a First Amendment organization I'm part of, to preserve the rights of people who read, who write, who draw, who sell, who publish comics. And I was an attraction on this cruise, and I was meant to be working on my novel, American Gods. But my assistant had put, by serendipity, the wrong notebook into my bag. So I got to this cruise, and I discovered that the notebook I had with me was Coraline. So on the cruise, I finished writing Coraline. So the truth is, I started writing it in 1991. I finished writing it in 2000. I have absolutely no idea how long it actually took me to write.
Sometimes I try to write a book, and it takes, like, when I was 5, I tried to, like, write a book, and I got, like, halfway through it when I became 6. So it took me to write just half of the book, and it only had, like, 5 pages.
Did you ever finish it?
I'm still working on it.
That's good.
Yeah.
Finishing books is the hardest thing.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can start writing a book,
yeah,
but you know you're a proper author when you finish one.
Mm-hmm. Like, in our school, in our classes, we're writing a lot of books in our classes, just like small books.
I'm loving writing the small books right now.
Yeah.
They're sort of, apart from anything else, it's really nice to do something that you can finish by tea time.
Yeah.
Emma, do you have any other questions for our guest?
Also, did anyone help you write Coraline at all?
No, it was all my fault. Any glory is mine, and any blame is mine, too. So for the people who think that writing Coraline was definitely a bad thing to do, I have to plead guilty.
I think it's really
good. I'll tell you what I did do, though. I stole the initial sort of idea from my daughter. Holly was about 4 years old. She used to come home from kindergarten. She would climb on my lap and dictate stories to me. And I would write them down. And they were always terrifying stories in which little girls, normally named Holly, would come home from school and discover that their mothers had been kidnapped by evil witches who were pretending to be their mothers, who would then normally lock them in the basement. And then with the aid of ghosts, they'd have to escape from the basement, pursued by witches, and go and try and find their real mother. And I thought, well, that's good. I'll write something like that for her. That's the kind of thing she likes.
That's sort of like what happens in some of my dreams sometimes.
I think it's what happens in everybody's dreams.
Yeah.
My dreams involve Terry Hatcher, but that's a whole other. I can't.
His dreams involve pretty much girls.
Especially your mother.
Neil,
good
answer.
Yes. Oh, I'm the third smartest person in my house.
It's true.
Let's put it this way. It's a Jane Austen world. I'm just the dad. I was curious, what other screenplays have come out recently that have really tapped, that you've really enjoyed watching or listening to?
What's been coming out recently that I've really enjoyed? I loved the screenplay For an Education.
Mm-hmm.
McCombie. I thought that was beautifully constructed. And actually, the things that have impressed me no end recently are the first two Stephen Moffat episodes of the new season of Doctor Who, because I think Moffat is probably right now my favorite screenwriter.
Okay.
Absolutely fascinated with the way that he'll construct a story. And up until now, at least in sort of, you know, his work in Doctor Who and in Jekyll, he's been the scary one.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is watching him develop a whole new, have to learn a whole new range. He can't just be the scary one anymore. He has to be the welcome everybody in one, and then he has to be the exciting running about one, and it's absolutely fascinating.
I'm curious if Doctor Who fans are in England, what Star Trek fans are here in the United States.
No.
No?
No.
Not as rabid?
Well, it's a general thing.
Okay.
I mean, Doctor Who in England is a huge shared cultural experience. You're looking at the kind of viewing figures that tell you that 10% of the population of England is watching this when it's on. I don't know what that would extrapolate to in the US, but you're looking at something that is a shared cultural experience, and it's a shared cultural experience that goes back 45 years.
Mm-hmm. It's true. You got me there.
You know, it's what I guess Star Trek could have been.
Right. But I think I only ask because since then, I mean, with and of course it spawned a legion of films and other series, and you know they're still talking about it, and they're obviously, you know, they made the film last year, so you know 40 some odd years later. But I think it's a different, because there's a Deep Space Nine and there's a Next Generation. It's not like Shatner and Nimoy for the entire time. Although
the genius of Doctor Who was that moment in 1966 when the producers looked at this fairly popular, you know, and it was extremely popular TV show that they'd done. It had already spawned two spin-off movies by that point. And they looked at this and they went, our lead actor is getting too old, too doddery, he's not actually in very good health. What do? We want to keep this going. Mm-hmm. And they went, well, he's an alien, he can regenerate into somebody else. And the simplicity of that gave them something that was unmatched until anything, like, you know, The Simpsons came along, for ways to cope with the fact that your actors may get old, die.
Terry Gilliam's last film, with three actors replacing one.
Exactly. The glory of Doctor Who now is that you have this weird shared cultural experience where for those of us who have been through this 11 times before, watching people whose first experience of Doctor Who was David Tennant go, no, how can David Tennant stop being the Doctor and somebody else will come on? This is wrong. It will not work. And all of us going, no, Grasshopper, this will be just fine.
Make them walk on rice paper. And
absolutely.
Neil, thank you so much for spending time with us. This has been an absolute thrill.
Well, thank you, Bo. Thank you, Emma. Great questions.
Thank you, Neil Gaiman.
Silent Breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Well, thanks to Emma for her questions. Thanks to Neil Gaiman. Thanks for everybody for listening and submitting questions. Next week, I will pay tribute to Lynn Redgrave, I assure you, as well as a couple other people that passed recently. Shout out to the Three Musketeers. Go see it tonight or tomorrow night at Mud Creek Players. So until next time, go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point, WFYI.org. Happy Mother's Day, everybody, to all the mothers with an O and a U. Take care.